streaming on Paramount Plus.
You ready, Bob?
Well, all right.
Audiences are raving. Bob Marley is electrifying. It's the feel-good movie of the year.
You dig?
Bob Marley, One Love. Rated PG-13. Now streaming on Paramount Plus.
Welcome to It's All Political, the San Francisco Chronicle's political podcast. I'm Joe Garofoli, the Chronicle's senior political writer, and today we're going to talk about Medicare for All. A bill that would create a Medicare for All health system is now before the House with more supporters than ever. But at this point, that's still not enough for it to become law. Nevertheless, its supporters, much like the advocates of same-sex marriage years ago, are taking the long view that it will someday soon. My guest today is one of the nation's leading advocates for Medicare for All, Dr. Abdul El-Sayed. Dr. El-Sayed is a multi-talented guy. He's a trained physician, he knows policy. For a while, he led the Detroit Department of Health, and he knows politics. He was a top surrogate for Senator Bernie Sanders during his 2020 presidential run, and the doctor ran for governor himself in Michigan in 2018. And he's got a new book out called Medicare for All, A Citizen's Guide, that he wrote with Dr. Micah Johnson. And now, here's our conversation about the politics of Medicare for All with Dr. Abdul El-Sayed. Dr. Abdul El-Sayed, from your home in Ann Arbor, Michigan, to mine in Oakland, welcome to It's All Political. How are you today?
Thank you so much for having me. All things considered, I'm doing okay. I'm pandemic well, as they say.
Pandemic well. I like that. I think I will officially steal that. So first of all, I want to commend our readers to your book, Medicare for All, A Citizen's Guide. It is easy to read, easy to understand, very straightforward. It is not a polemic, if that's what you fear. It has definitely has a point of view, but it is it's not offensive to those who might be like, I don't want to read about Medicare for All. It's really straightforward. Okay, now, since this is, it's all political, you write in your book, quote, policy remains a matter of theory if it is not politically practicable. So let's talk about the politics of Medicare for All. Last week, Congresswoman Jayapal, who's been a guest on this show, and Congresswoman Debbie Dingell introduced it in the House. It has more than half the Democratic caucus on board, but as we know, passage in the House is not a given, certainly, and passage in the Senate is going to be really tough, where the Democrats have the slimmest of margins. Now, I wrote about this about a month into the shutdown, and you talk about this in the book, that for all the devastation that the pandemic has done to us, it may have helped the cause of Medicare for All. Tell us a little bit about why you feel that way.
Well, I think Americans watched as this pandemic waylaid a structurally unsound healthcare system throughout the pandemic, whether it was watching nurses and doctors and healthcare workers in hospitals trying to care for patients on limited ventilators in garbage bags and months-old masks, or was watching 15 million of our loved ones or friends and family, our coworkers, lose their healthcare because they lost their jobs in the middle of the worst global pandemic in over a century. Mm-hmm. Or it was the fact that we did not have the healthcare infrastructure or the public health infrastructure to prevent this or respond to this in a meaningful way. It's obvious that our healthcare system was simply not up to the task. And if we're not serious about taking on the rot at the core of this healthcare system and the structural deficits that left us where we've been for the last year plus, then, you know, at some point we have to ask if we're serious about healthcare as a human right in this country at all. And so I do think that this pandemic has shown the healthcare system for what it is. It put it through possibly the worst stress test you could imagine, and our healthcare system was found wanting, which forces the question, how do we fix it? And I think Medicare for All is the right approach to addressing the structural deficit at the heart of the failures of our healthcare system over the past 15 months. And I think Americans are looking at it with a new lens.
So we have, under Medicare for All, everyone would have been covered. So if you lost your job because of what happened during the pandemic, you would be covered, et cetera, et cetera. But there's also the coordination aspect. Took us months for various hospital systems, that do not talk to each other, to start talking to each other. That's sort of one of those behind-the-scenes parts of Medicare for All that don't get talked about as much. That would have been a different scene if we had Medicare for All, correct?
You're right. I mean, in the same way that the rest of our healthcare system has been balkanized for corporate profit, the method of communication, right, the electronic medical record, has been similarly balkanized. And what that means is that you have different hospitals and databases that don't talk to each other as a means of protection for the others, right? And this is what happens across the board when the healthcare system is leveraged for profit, and that becomes the number one goal, rather than a healthcare system that is oriented to the well-being of the people it's supposed to serve. And so this is just another example of how the incentive to try and make money off of sick people interrupts our ability to take care of those people when they're sick.
You wear many hats. You're a licensed medical doctor, but you're also a policy expert. So let's wonk out a little bit about where this goes in Washington. You're still short of votes. The healthcare industry, bottomless pockets and enormous sway. But one thing that I found interesting in the book is you write that there's several swing contingencies that could help you here that weren't in play before. And among them are doctors, not specialists, like, say, neurologists, or for example, they get more money the more they bill. But family doctors and pediatricians, the docs who many of us see most often, you said that they have, you feel that they could be much more supportive and much more vocally supportive of you. Why is that?
Well, I want to correct the record. I'm not a practicing clinician. In fact, I went to medical school and decided specifically not to practice because
of how
broken...
But you have a license, that you have a degree.
I have a degree, yeah. I finished my MD, but so I have a plaque on the wall that says I'm a medical doctor, but okay. I did not pursue a medical license to practice medicine. And the reason why, frankly, is because our healthcare system could not achieve the goals that I had for my career, which is alleviating the kinds of inequities that shape healthcare access in our country. And so I wanted my work to be about trying to fix the system so that doctors could be about fixing patients in the system. And
yes, thank you for correcting me.
No, I want to correct the record because I think for so many physicians, like the ones that I graduated with, they're graduating into a healthcare system that does not allow them to achieve the ends that they had for their careers. People don't get into medicine, because they want to watch their patients struggle to pay their bills for the care that they provided them. People get into medicine because they want to make people feel better, and this system fails to do that. So what's happening right now is physician interests are shifting, I think, dramatically when it comes to the structure of our healthcare system, because in a lot of ways, the healthcare system has cheated doctors out of a lot of the things that they had expected. The first is a paycheck, right? Obviously, doctors are known for earning a relatively healthy paycheck, certainly. But what's happened over time is that whereas physicians used to mostly work for other physicians or for themselves as small business owners in a practice, they can no longer compete with the larger healthcare providers, the big gargantuan corporate healthcare systems that have moved in that can leverage their size and their heft to command higher reimbursement rates than the smaller guys can. And so what happens is they get outcompeted and bought up. And so now as a physician, you don't really have the option to work for yourself or to start a small business. You're stuck working for a major corporation where rather than MDs at the top, you've got MBAs who are making huge amounts of money off of the system and off of your labor. Meanwhile, more importantly, you're watching your patients struggle to be able to afford the care that you provide them with less and less time that you get to provide that care. And so for the first time in 2018, the median physician no longer worked for a physician-owned practice. And for the first time in 2018, the median physician supported single-payer healthcare. Those two things are very related. So I think doctors are changing in their perspective. And of course, this falls on a historical backdrop where physicians were some of the leading advocates against any form of government health insurance in the past. I mean, the first real push for government healthcare happened during the Truman years, National Health Insurance Program, and the American Medical Association paid $5 million, which at that time was a gargantuan sum of money, to kill it. And that's what happened. And they've been opposed to any sort of universal government health insurance plan ever since. But I think that's starting to change quite a bit. as physicians are starting to realize that they've been swept under the rug by a system that is driven by corporate profit rather than their well-being and, more importantly, their patients' well-being.
The AMA, of course, is not doctors, is not a doctors, individual doctors. Do you sense that the AMA, the American Medical Association, could come on board with this? Or do you think there's still too much in the hands of corporate profit and the industry?
I think they're going to be one of the last holdouts. Okay. You know, most recently they were part of the founding membership of a corporate junta called the Partnership for America's Healthcare Future, which if you remember watching the 2019-2020 primary season, they're the ones who ran all those ads smearing Medicare for All. And then as soon as, you know, very tellingly, as soon as now President Joe Biden won the nomination, they just changed the verbiage in the ads. So instead of being about Medicare for All, they were about the public option. And, you know, that tells us something really profound about the nature of opposition. This industry wants to maintain the status quo at all costs. And so sometimes there's this assumption that because Medicare for All goes further than something like a public option, that of course the opposition that we'd get is further too. The problem is that the industry only has two settings, on or off. They're either going to fully oppose or not. And so anyone thinking that, you know, the public option is a better middle way because it's not going to draw the same kind of ire from the industry is mistaken. Because look at the kind of ire that the ACA drew. And that was fixated on a private system of insurance. And so I think we've got to learn our lesson from the hand that they've shown us and recognize that we're going to get opposition for any sort of attempt to address the status quo. And the status quo is fundamentally unsustainable. It has been sending people into bankruptcy and denying them healthcare for decades now.
So another swing constituency that you talk about in the book is organized labor. Now, here in California, especially here in the Bay Area, we're home to the National Nurses United, very powerful Oakland headquartered labor union that's long been a leader in Medicare for All. So is the SEIU. But other labor unions are a little bit more reluctant to come forward. And I hear this from my friends in unions. They're like, well, my benefits are better than Medicare for All or better than Medicare. And they're concerned that Medicare for All would be almost like a step down for them. But that too is changing. And I think there's been some tweaks to the legislation that might bring those folks on board. You want to talk about those?
Yeah. Look, I think part of this is that the industry has spent so much money fear-mongering people about what they would lose out of a system that is constantly extracting from them in the first place. And, you know, they've been able to fear-monger unions to say, well, you all have worked so hard to negotiate these incredible rates for your members that that's all going to be gone under Medicare for All. The fact is that what's not being said is that all of the resources that go into healthcare on behalf of union members by their employers, those are resources that would be freed up to invest in families, in so many other far more empowering ways if you didn't have to worry about whether or not you'd have healthcare. And so, you know, we are so stuck on the system that we have right now that sometimes I think we lack the imagination. I say this as a proud union member and somebody who believes deeply in organized labor. And, you know, God bless the nurses for leading on this fight, because they're the folks who see healthcare on both sides. Not only are they constantly bargaining in the same way that every union is, but they work inside the system and they see the system's inefficiencies and brokenness every single day. And I think their leadership matters a lot because it shows us exactly what we're fighting for, and it reminds us of the moral clarity of what healthcare ought to be in the first place.
We'll have more of our conversation about the politics of Medicare for All with Dr. Abdul El-Sayed after this short break.
With threats to our nation waiting around every corner, adaptability is more important than ever. When conditions change without notice, quick strategic thinking is crucial. And with obstacles consistently impending, determination is essential in overcoming them. It's this willingness, decisiveness, and resilience that sets Marines apart. With our fighting spirit, we don't just fight battles. We win them. Marines are the constant our nation counts on to fight the unknown. And through adaptable problem solving, we do just that. Learn more at Marines.com.
And now, here's more of our conversation about Medicare for All with Dr. Abdul El-Sayed. When you look at polls, and you quote polls throughout the book, but one poll that always comes up, and you reference this too, is that people are very supportive of Medicare for All, even a sizable chunk of Republicans, until they were asked in a poll or told that it would mean that they would lose their private health insurance. Now, as you're right, the poll question doesn't often say that they will also, you know, they will lose their private health insurance, but they will get a comprehensive plan, you know, in its stead. But still, people are, you know, for most of us get our health insurance through our work. That it's a sort of a bedrock thing where we're kind of tied to that private health insurance. Walk me through this. I'm a Kaiser member. Mm-hmm. I have Kaiser health insurance today. If Medicare for All were to pass tomorrow, what would that mean? I like my Kaiser doc. Can I still go to him there? What would that mean for me from a day-to-day perspective?
Yeah, the part that they don't tell you about the polls is that it's true that when you tell people that they would lose their private health insurance, support for Medicare for All drops. But here's the part they don't tell you, that when you tell them that they would definitely be able to keep their doctor, it's not only that that support for Medicare for All goes back up, it in fact goes back up even higher than it had been in the first place.
Yes.
And the fact is that right now, the single biggest gatekeeper around what doctor you can see, what hospital you can go to, is your health insurer. Right, they negotiate these sweetheart rates with these different insurers and different hospitals, and you're not allowed to step outside of that sweetheart deal, or you're going to be hit with an absurd bill that's oftentimes many times the size you would have paid if you stayed within the deal. And so under Medicare for All, you have one national health insurance plan. In effect, every physician, every provider, every hospital would be forced to take it. Otherwise, you know, there are no other insurers out there. And so, yes, you could see not just those doctors that are currently in your network that you like to see. You could see any doctor you want. And that's a really, really important recognition and something that's often hidden away by folks who want to frame Medicare for All as being about loss, when in fact, Medicare for All, frankly, is about liberty and about gain. And so that's really critical. So for you, you know, as a Kaiser member, if we were to pass Medicare for All tomorrow, the health insurance part of your Kaiser plan, Kaiser's unique. It's not like most of the other health insurance systems, because it runs its own hospitals and employs its own doctors. And so it's this sort of mini national health insurance program akin to the UK's. Ostensibly, right, the insurance part of your Kaiser plan would go away, but the providers would still be there. You could still go into a Kaiser hospital and see your Kaiser doctor, and that wouldn't change, because Kaiser, like all of the other providers, would really have to continue to take the national health program. Otherwise, in effect, it would be rendering itself moot as a provider.
The politics are two people who are not on board with the Medicare for All, one of many key people then, and is Nancy Pelosi. And she likes to say that she was for single payer, you know, before any of us were born. Even with the Affordable Care Act, she wouldn't allow the public option to be included in that. What needs to happen to change her mind? And why doesn't she get more heat for not being supportive of this? She's seen as one of the most progressive people in the country. She represents possibly the most progressive district in the country. How important is Pelosi, and why doesn't she get more heat for it?
Well, I'll tell you this. She was for Medicare for All. I don't know what happened to make her become faint of heart on it, but you know, I'd love to see her support it again. I think it's the right thing for our country. It's the right thing, certainly, for her constituents, and you know, if you were to pull her constituents out in the Bay Area, I'm rather certain the majority of them support Medicare for All. At the same time, there is a lot of power that the corporate insurance industry has. They spent $152 million last year alone lobbying politicians. They spent $120 million electioneering, donating to politicians. And, you know, if you're the Speaker of the House, unfortunately, right, in this current moment, so many Democrats take money from this industry that it becomes almost untenable not to do the bidding of the industry. And this is why the fight for Medicare for All really has to be about democracy for reform in general, right? So long as these corporations continue to be able to buy the support of our politicians, we are not going to have a politics that can put the people over the corporations and their profits. And I think the story of Speaker Pelosi's support and then non-support, I think, tracks with that rather clearly. At the same time, I don't believe that we're going to get Medicare for All under a Biden administration, right? I assume the second of the two people that you were going to mention was President Biden.
He was, yes.
Yeah, he does not support Medicare for All. He's made that rather clear, and it's unlikely that we're going to get Medicare for All under his leadership. At the same time, though, this is the moment where we do that deep organizing that can determine whether or not we get Medicare for All in the future. And I want folks to understand that even if it's not going to happen in the next 2 or 4 years, that what we do today is going to dictate whether or not it's going to happen in the long term. And if we believe in this thing, our belief can't hinge on a 1 to 2 year time horizon. Is that we've got to be working tirelessly for it now. And so, frankly, whether or not these politicians support it or they don't, it doesn't change the fact that it's the right thing to do. It doesn't change the fact that, the power building that we need to do has to be ongoing, has to continue. And it doesn't change the fact that, in the future, it's going to be increasingly untenable for a Democratic politician to run for office, let alone hold a place of deep power without supporting this policy change.
Well, and I think that's what maybe at the root of Pelosi's reluctance is now that she's, the speaker. She's concerned about all those Democrats in swing districts where if they were to run for Medicare for All, they feel that, they would be, we hear the same old stuff from the Republicans, that socialized medicine, it's, a government-run program, et cetera, et cetera. You're too far left for the district. And fewer are willing to go there. What do you do about those folks?
Well, I'll say this: the majority of Democrats in the House support Medicare for All, right? That's number one. Number two, I actually just think that is a very old, outdated way of thinking about where our politics are today. And the reason why is this: I think,
but it's legit. They do feel that way.
They may feel that way. And I think that oftentimes has more to do with what their donors tell them than what their constituents tell them. Because if you poll Republicans, right, there was an interesting poll of Republicans in swing states back in 2019 that asked how many points would Donald Trump lose if he supported Medicare for All? And the poll found that he'd lose 2 points. 2 points. Indeed, if you actually look at support for Medicare for All among Republicans, it's quite high. Another poll found that 50% of Republicans thought that Medicare for All should be a high priority for President Biden and the Democratic Congress. And so there's this notion somehow that, the world is this ideologically consistent place. But if you look at where the Republican base is, they tend to be folks who are, frankly, the most hurt by the brokenness in our healthcare system. You look at rural communities, they've hemorrhaged their hospitals because they cannot maintain a profit. And because they can't maintain a profit, that means hospitals are closing down. That means that people have to drive 2 hours, 3 hours sometimes to get care urgently. And that really is a travesty. That's if, you're privileged enough to have health insurance, which a large proportion of people don't. And so, as the base of the Republican Party becomes lower and lower income, which is happening, I think Medicare for All is becoming a higher and higher space of interest. Now, there are other challenges there because we found that, of course, even if you take a health reform approach like the ACA that originated as a conservative idea and try and implement it in a Democratic administration, there's going to be major blowback. But that tells us that it's not really about ideology as much as it is about negative partisanship. And so, if you're going to get blowback for being a Democrat anyway, you might as well try and get that blowback doing something that's going to help your constituents.
And might as well just go for it and You're gonna hear about it one way or the other. Why not do something that stays close to your values?
Exactly.
You compare this in the book at one point to the and you alluded to this a minute ago about sort of this is a long game you're playing. You're not going to get it under a Biden presidency. this is a long game you're playing. And you compared it to the battle for same-sex marriage. And it's funny you say that, because just the other day I was having a conversation with someone who has been involved in that for you know, it's much of its long, its modern arc from the time. And you know, there was for a while here, even here in California, the battle for same-sex marriage was about, this is a right. This is, you know, this is about fairness, et cetera, et cetera. That argument, they lost 30, 35 times in states around the country with that argument. When they switched to to describing this as, this is about love. This is about who you love. We should all be able to love who we love. Then they started to see some success. Is there something that needs to change in the core messaging of Medicare for All in a similar way? And as you point out in the book, of course, people who were opposed to same-sex marriage did not have, you know, trillions of dollars in assets like the hospital industry does. But is there need to be a change in messaging that could touch the heartstrings as opposed to maybe the purse strings as much?
You know, I think sometimes we attribute social change to a singular moment rather than the architecture that was created by a full movement. And, you know, it takes both. It takes a very strong, direct justice message, but it also takes a hopeful, honest human message. And it takes them both in concert. And I think we're in a moment where the work that's been done to introduce the idea of a national health insurance program akin to Medicare for All, right? I think that's really powerful and really important. I do think that the message is going to shift. It's going to change. And frankly, I think what's going to change it is that we've just come through this moment of deep and profound pain in this country, centralized around a healthcare system that was not up to the task, that left us in a situation where our hospitals were filling up. 15 million people lost their health insurance, and probably most importantly, at least now, 540,000 and counting people have lost their lives. Millions more have lost their livelihoods. And so this moment, right, I think forces us to think about how do we talk about this issue as a solution to the set of problems that we're coming out of. Because in the end, right, narratives change as a function of the circumstances of a moment, and the circumstances have deeply changed over the last year since the last time we had this conversation, this debate, through the course of the 2020 primaries. And so, yes, I do think it will change, but I also think that there's been some amazing groundwork laid by, you know, Senator Sanders and all of the Congress people and senators who have run on and won on this issue. And so I'm looking forward to that next iteration. But either way, right, either way, I think that this movement is building. Momentum has never been stronger than it is right now. I know that's hard to believe given where we are. But if you look at, you know, the metrics in Congress, you got folks like Frank Pallone, a 17th term congressman, who's nobody's progressive, but is supporting Medicare for All because he sees it as an answer to this moment.
Right. And an important committee chair as well. One quick thing, because I know people are going to be asking about this at this point. Who's going to pay for this? How much is this going to cost me?
Yeah.
And I know your price of healthcare will go down. Your taxes may go up for many of us. But who's going to be paying? How much out of pocket is this going to cost me compared to now?
Well, the good news is that it's going to cost us zero out of pocket in the sense of deductibles and co-pays. These out-of-pocket costs that are so surprising that send 67% of all people who go bankrupt into bankruptcy, these go away. And so it's going to be cheaper. And yes, we are going to pay for it, right? But we pay for healthcare now. And we pay 18% of the entire economy for healthcare. Under Medicare for All, we pay substantially less. And more importantly, because it's financed in a progressive way, low-income people and people who are struggling don't get priced out of the system. Rather, their costs go down and it becomes an affordable thing. And so because everyone pays into the system, it is a collective good that all of us fund, but all of us fund in a progressive way that is fairer than the system that we have today.
And so can you say if someone makes the wealthier people are going to pay more for this.
That's right.
How much? So, how are we defining wealthy? Because, of course, our value of that here in California is skewed.
Right. If you're someone who's making, you know, in the multiple hundreds of thousands of dollars range, you know, the high likelihood is that your healthcare costs are going to stay the same or slightly increase. But if you're someone who's earning the median of, say, $70,000 a year for a family of four, your healthcare costs are going to decrease substantially. And the important thing to remember here is it's not just that we're taking the same cost and distributing it in a different way. It's that the overall cost goes down substantially as well because we're eliminating all of those overheads. We don't have to pay CEOs tens of millions of dollars for in effect, denying us the healthcare that we already paid for. Instead, that money is spent far more efficiently and is spread around in a far more equitable way.
And okay, give us a couple of key points to watch for in the upcoming weeks. If people want to get involved, what should they be doing?
Yeah, so there are a lot of amazing organizations that are doing this work. Folks like People's Action and Be a Hero and the Center for Popular Democracy and the Nurses Union and the SEIU. And I encourage you to get involved there. But also, I think some of the most important organizing happens ad hoc with our friends and our loved ones and our family members. I hope folks will keep watching because I'm looking forward to a series of hearings. You mentioned Frank Pallone. He's the chair of the Energy and Commerce Committee, and he's promised a Medicare for All hearing. So I'm expecting that there are going to be some great Medicare for All hearings in the near future. And I hope folks that will pay attention and really, really make sure that you are doing your part to pressure your elected officials to get right on this issue, because it is a matter of justice, but it's also a matter of our morals. Do we believe that healthcare is a human right? Do we believe that everybody deserves it? And if we do, then we have the opportunity through this bill, through this movement, to achieve that in our country once and for all.
Dr. Abdul Sayed, thank you so much for your time. The book is called Medicare for All, A Citizen's Guide. Thank you for being on It's All Political. I appreciate it.
It's my privilege. Thanks for having me.
I'd like to thank you all for listening and hope that you and your families are safe and healthy. I'd like to thank Dr. El Sayed for joining us today on the podcast. I'd like to thank the King, King Kaufman, for producing today's episode. And as always, got to give a shout out to our fabulous theme music. That's Cattle Call, and it's written by Randy Clark and performed by Randy Clark and Crow Song. And remember, no matter how long you think it will be to pass Medicare for All, it's all political.